Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, a very pleasant good afternoon to you. We are back here. It is about a little bit afternoon, a couple minutes afternoon, Central Time, OneRadioNetwork.com, and this is Patrick Timpone. The gentleman you see, the picture you'll see to my immediate left, is Dr. Ray Peet. He's a PhD. He's been at this game of nutrition and such for a very, very long time, and taught at medical universities, and lived down in Mexico for a while, and he's been working with the people, and now he just writes. He does his own newsletter, Ray Peet newsletter. We'll let you know how to get that one. And he's got me drinking a lot of orange juice. Well, you didn't really get me drinking orange juice, but after talking to you for a long time, Dr. Peet, I'm drinking a lot of orange juice, and I can't believe, you know, I went my whole life, Dr. Peet, thinking, well, orange juice was just, it can't be good. I mean, it's just too much sugar, right? I just didn't do it.
Yeah, a lot of people are still saying that, but if you look at the total picture, it even contains some protein, but one of the most important things is the anti-inflammatory flavonoids. It's like a medical shop in terms of the complexity of the anti-inflammatory mixture in it.
But so all the sugar obviously doesn't, I mean, it doesn't have any negative effects for me anyway.
High content of potassium in the juice, potassium has a function similar to insulin. It lets you absorb and use the sugar without resorting to increased insulin. It doesn't at all have the fattening influence that starches or a plain sugar would have.
So you could almost get more of an insulin thing or a sugar with a big plate of pasta than you can orange juice, right?
Yeah. The sugar in orange juice is mostly sucrose, which in itself is much less glycemic or insulin-stimulating than the glucose that drives from starch.
Okay, so we pasta, bread, and things like that, that's more of a glucose, and that plays more, have an effect on the insulin.
There are charts of the glycemic index. Foods, starch and glucose are at the top, and juices are actually down the list.
Okay. So, generally, when folks want to lose weight, we get plenty of those questions. What are some things that you recommend that they do, you know, to take out and to put in, to lose weight?
One of the things you want to do is stop eating the things that slow your metabolism, that inhibit your thyroid damage your mitochondria and block oxygen use and heat production. And the worst of those foods are the polyunsaturated fats very high starchy foods like pasta are the next in line. But the PUFA accumulate in your body and turn off your thyroid in different ways and damage your mitochondria so that your ability to burn calories decreases as the polyunsaturated fat in the food is stored in your body. Canola, corn oil, safflower,
soy oil.
All of those. Highly polyunsaturated. Butter is a very relatively highly saturated food, and so it can be fattening if you eat enough of it, but against a background of history of having eaten a lot of soy oil and so on, just adding a little coconut oil, which is quickly absorbed and oxidized, can increase your heat production. But the ability to produce heat from your food is the thing to pay attention to. And sugar, in a lot of experiments, just adding sugar to your diet can increase your metabolic rate by 20%.
And so you can actually lose weight in eating, increasing your metabolism with sugar.
Yeah, if you're shifting from a standard diet that's high in polyunsaturated fat, shifting to include things like a lot of fruit or orange juice in particular, you can keeping your calories at the same level, your metabolic rate is going to increase so that you'll be hotter, your temperature will not drop so low during the night, and will tend to stay around the normal 98.6 during the daytime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the proof is then, Dr. Pete, or they're mostly, I guess, I don't know if people even use corn oil. I guess they do. But mostly in more processed foods, right? Like salad dressings and all kinds of stuff where they put coconut oil and soybean oil. That's probably where people get most of them?
Yeah, and mayonnaise and salad
mayonnaise, yeah, all that stuff, yeah. They put those poofers everywhere.
So yeah.
They put them everywhere, right? So that's the main...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When they started doing that is when Americans started getting obese.
Huh.
And during this time, there have been people claiming that too much sugar is why Americans are getting obese. But if you look at the grain products consumption during the last several decades, that's what has increased, and the refined sugar has actually not increased during this obesity epidemic.
Right.
The background of it is that in the 1950s, they were selling the idea that polyunsaturated fats are essential oils, and they blurred that concept of essentiality to mean good for you regardless of the quantity. And so they said the more you eat, the lower your cholesterol will be.
Oh.
And they were basing the whole thing on the idea of cholesterol as a poisonous material rather than a defensive substance, mm-hmm. protective
substance, mm-hmm. for the arteries to...
Protective for the brain.
The brain and
the heart. Everything depends on cholesterol as a source of, for example, progesterone. Cholesterol, if you are studying the amount of progesterone that an ovary can produce, and you add cholesterol to the blood going into the ovary, the amount of progesterone increases coming out the other side of the ovary. So it's massively, constantly being used for protective substances.
Really? Wow. Very interesting. This is a great question I want to ask you about. So it's been said, do you think that men and women actually smell the immune system? Do you think that's possible of the other person, and that's why they're attracted to them? Some people argue that, well, you're attracted to a person because they got a good immune system and they could maybe have children. Do you think that's possible?
Oh, sure.
Oh, sure, he said. Oh, really? I thought it was kind of crazy thing. Really, tell me.
Not just the immune system, but the pheromones, in the case of the attractiveness of men to women, there's a definite derivative of testosterone, which is very volatile, tends to come out through the skin constantly. And the amount of that, people have experimented with it, extracting it right from the surface of the skin,
right,
or synthesizing the same chemical, putting a tiny amount, just a milligram or so, on a like a mask, and putting it on the women as they're evaluating just pictures of a man, for example.
Okay.
And they'll say the man is beautiful and intelligent and kind and so on, if they have that pheromone present.
Isn't that fat? So if they smell a little testosterone, it's almost like a instinctual, spiritual, whatever deep thing that maybe they can have a baby, which is like what a lot of girls want to do, right? They have babies.
Yeah. I got interested in that when I was
fascinating
about 11 months old.
Come on, really?
I had a 15-year-old babysitter, and I remember standing on her thigh, and my nose had just reached her cheek, and I remember the intoxicating smell of this young, healthy woman as better than any flower perfume.
Isn't that? And you remember this when you were 11 months old, Dr. P.
That was such an outstanding experience for
me. How can you forget that, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it? And so it was like a normal kind of thing. You were a guy and you kind of smelt this because this young, vibrant, fertile woman.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So I wonder what that would do then to ladies who go on the pill. You think that would stop this instinct? And
really,
the guys would not be able to smell them? Or
To a great extent it does. The progesterone level following ovulation, it's the source of much of that aroma.
Oh, so when you're ovulating, then you get the progesterone, and that might attract the guys.
Yeah.
Right? But if she's on the pill...
There's no cycle.
There's no cycle, of course. Could that affect her ability to smell the guys if she's on the pill?
I think it does.
There's been stories, and I don't know how true this is, that some women, you know, they marry guys because they're on the pill, right, the whole time? And so they marry him because of whatever reason. And then they get off the pill to get a baby, and then they don't like the smell of the guy because they picked the wrong guy. That could be true. I mean, that's a crazy story, but, you know.
I think it's very logical, biologically.
Wow. They don't teach you this stuff in PhD school, do they?
No. I started reading about it because of my awareness of the difference in the skin perfume of different young women, a tremendous difference in attractiveness. So I looked up a lot of the studies with animal pheromones, animals communicate very powerfully.
Yeah.
They can detect something like one molecule per several cubic centimeters, a dilution that you can't detect with any sort of instrument.
Mm-hmm.
A moth can detect a potential mate a mile away.
Yeah. And so that would really put a damper on this whole idea of perfumes, right? Wouldn't you just be blocking all that stuff, even shaving lotion, anything, wouldn't you?
Unless they put pheromones in it.
Oh, do they do that?
Yeah.
Oh, good. That's smart. Where do they get these pheromones? From girls?
No, they just use synthetic chemicals.
They use synthetic chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, you're talking about looking for love in all the wrong places. Boy, that could get you confused.
Yeah.
You know, I wondered about that, about dogs. Like, I have a golden doodle, and so I'll throw the ball, and maybe she'll not see it or miss it and go into the woods or something, or the weeds. And she'll just go around for 5 minutes before smelling it. Now, how can she smell my hands on that ball, and it's 30 feet away? I mean, that's amazing, isn't it, when you think about it? Amazing.
Yeah, people studying moth perception it's easier to take a moss apart and figure out how it's reacting than with a mammal. But dogs are just almost as sensitive as moths in detecting just an occasional molecule. And people studying the moths have argued that it isn't possible that you could detect a gradient of a mate a mile away. The number of molecules diffusing over such a huge space, it's just beyond a possible random chance. And so they have studied usually in the infrared radiation frequency, and the vibration of a molecule every time that the atoms oscillate farther away and closer to each other, mm-hmm. sort of a bouncing effect within the molecule, each movement emits in the infrared frequency. And they show that the moths are detecting infrared radiation emitted by these distant molecules, so that the molecule doesn't really have to contact the animal. It's emitting a field that the animal detects.
My goodness. So no wonder they can smell rabbits. And in the old days, they used to chase hounds, right? Or even criminals, right? They get these bloodhounds after criminals.
And people actually are much more sensitive. The special nerve apparatus that connects the emotional meaning of a pheromone to the brain, that's actually much more sensitive than a person's conscious sense of smell, so that these influences happen far beyond our conscious awareness of smelling a person. Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting there with someone and we're just kind of falling madly, right? There's no telling what's going on. There could be a lot of stuff going on all different levels, not that you're just physically attracted to.
The physical attraction really is
not much.
most of it is happening subliminally through your nose.
Wow. Ray Peters with us, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. He's here on the third Monday, but we had a technical. Mercury in retrograde was having a bad hair day, but he agreed to come back. So thanks so much for coming back and the following day, Dr. Pete. We have lots of good questions for you, but I'm really going to just throw this out there because I've been wanting to ask you, how do you, this is kind of a big one, but go ahead. How do you think we evolved, our species, the human species? I'm sure you've got a lot of theories and all the deep work and research that you've done over all these years. Do you have some your own theory about how this all happened, how we got here?
The origin of life is the first big question. And I think, for example, there's a youngish professor at MIT who shows that just shining light on molecules, they tend to become organized. Just the energy of the light is enough to create organization. Mm-hmm. And so energy flowing through substance is always an organizing principle and process. So the primitive origin of living material is much simpler than the people with a mechanistic assumption of randomness mm-hmm. in the universe. Mm-hmm. You can't explain anything happening once you commit to that mechanical faith in randomness. It just never happens. With the flow of energy leading to organization, things happen spontaneously. Professor of chemistry was his origin, Sidney Fox, demonstrated he believed that volcanic energy was the source of this flow of energy that was most relevant, although the solar energy is another guiding factor. But he showed that if you take a mixture of a random assortment of amino acids, and the amino acids can occur spontaneously, you find them drifting around in space between stars, so there's no shortage of amino acids. But he threw some of those on hot volcanic rocks and then sprinkled water on it. The two simplest operations, and then looked at the result under a microscope, and he saw what looked like a multitude of small round bacteria. Spontaneously formed proteins from the heat and water combination. Then he showed that those little bacteria-like spheres could assimilate proteins, assimilate amino acids, and make new proteins. So they had the enzyme-like function spontaneously. It didn't take a chance a billion years to create anything. It was popping right out of the nature of existence. So it's like life is built. It's a property of matter that simply takes the right conditions to be expressed.
So then from this idea, then life just sprung out of whatever God is, and then we evolved. Do you think the species evolved through the oceans and stuff like that? I mean, it just...
If it went off in the ocean, right. It might develop
something.
Jellyfish mm-hmm. or something appropriate for the situation. But I think the tendency is not just to produce life, but to produce more and more life. More and more
intelligence, more awareness.
Intelligence, yeah.
Yeah, more awareness
that's a just as much a part of the nature of the universe as to spontaneously form life.
Mm-hmm.
It's to lead to more and more life and more intelligence.
Yeah, that would be the God force of just to express more of intelligence, right? More, more and more intelligence.
Yeah, it implies a sort of pantheism.
Yeah. So, but what about the whole monkey ape thing? That didn't happen, right? I mean,
the which thing?
The monkeys and the apes and all that, and that whole missing link thing. That never. I mean, we are separate from the apes, right? Humans.
The chimpanzees went off on a strange vegetarian diet. I think humans needed, for one thing, a high concentration of energy in the environment, and living in an area with good fruit, where energy grows on trees. I think that's the most likely thing that we could satisfy our need for more and more energy if we had an abundance of sugar-rich, somewhat protein-providing food available.
Right. So this idea would not be, there'd be no elimination or separation from a divine creation or God, whatever you want to call it, because it's all part of this, right? This is all, we're all immersed in the whole process, God is, whatever God is.
Yeah, there's no random chance.
No chance.
Involved in the creative process.
So if I think we're spiritual beings, souls, I wonder when they pop in, maybe they pop in, maybe souls exist in the sand and stuff, and amoebas, right?
Yeah, the question of where soul appears in the universe.
Yeah.
People have been more and more generous. They used to say babies were unconscious, didn't experience pain. Even when I was in graduate school, my professors said, no, you don't need to anesthetize a baby to do surgery, because even though they might be screaming and turning red, their brains aren't developed enough
really?
To experience
They told you that in school?
Right, 1957.
My goodness, what are these guys smoking?
That was a standard psychologist opinion.
Wow, man.
At the time, I understood that they were insane, but...
You knew they were crackers, right? You knew they were... Wow. And so I guess when they then... what do they call it when they take the skin off, the foreskin and all that? What do they do that?
Yeah, there are still people who argue you don't need an anesthetic.
Really? To do that? To get a... What do they call that?
Circumcision.
Yeah, circumcision. So people that argue you don't need to do that because the babies don't feel pain?
That's still argued.
My goodness. I wonder where that whole circumcision came from. Is that a religious thing?
Yeah. There have been a few people traced back the history of it, and it's pretty obvious that it was intended as an anti-sexual thing.
Anti-sexual?
Make mating more controllable.
Why would that be?
For authoritarian purposes, I think. You don't want people running around mating just whenever they feel like it. And,
sure.
So to have a stable society, it's easier if they dull their sexual responses.
So actually circumcision dulls the sexual? I thought it was the opposite, where it makes the penis more... without the skin, it makes it more...
The opposite? Protects the surface membrane so that they're extremely oversensitive, but without the foreskin, the surface of the end of the penis becomes thickened and loses its sensibility.
Really? Wow. That's no fun. So, Dr. Ray Peters with it. I can't believe we just went there. But that's okay. Stay right there. We're going to do a little commercial, and then we'll take some emails. Ready? We got some good ones for you.
Okay?
Stay right there. Dr. Ray P., Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Hey, so much fun to talk to. I'm going to tell you all about his website in just a second and where you can get his newsletter. And it's, I'll tell you right now, it's Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com. Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com. And you can just go on there and you send him an email. That's an email address, sorry. And then you send him an email and you just sign up, and it's very affordable. I don't know. I don't even remember what it was, but it's just not much money at all. And it comes out every couple months. Some really cool stuff and pretty geeky things about your health and that you just won't hear anywhere else. So that's a nice way to support him. Just Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com. There you go. This is a conversation with Phil, who sells and the distributor of Arsana a few years ago. I mean, this is a while ago, but he's a cool guy. Listen.
Previously, with a longtime friend, Phil Wilson, the exclusive distributor of the Relax Far Infrared Sauna.
I've been sweating and promoting the benefits of saunas and sweating for 16 years now. Can you believe it?
Wow, 16 years. Regularly that long?
20 minutes a day for about 15 years now.
6 months ago, man, I started doing it every day, and I don't think I've missed a day. How this has improved my life, I mean, I can't tell you. It's pretty amazing. I tell you what, I feel better and better. What's going on?
Well, the proof is definitely in the pudding. And if a person would go to YouTube and search for Relax Sauna Testimonials, they'll get 650 testimonies on what the Relax Sauna has done for different individuals, from feeling better to getting rid of extreme pain to getting rid of neuropathy to just helping a person feel more calm, alert, relaxed, tuned in, and everything else.
And everything else. These are really nice units. Right now, our current price, because they went up a little bit over in the beginning, you know, a few months ago, it was all about the shipping coming in. These are made at a medical university in Taiwan. Really nice units. You can see a picture on audio. You can just go on our website and check out the picture. And it's a personal unit. They come with a very nice chair. Put a towel over that puppy, and then you just sweat. Oh, you got to make sure you're drinking plenty of water and get your little electrolyte things that I do. I use a calcium, I think it's calcium bicarbonate, a couple other things. I use a liquid one. That's the one I like. But, you know, you can find some different, different electrolytes. And, well, ask Dr. Pete about some electrolytes in foods. I guess food. I bet you my orange juice got electrolytes. Anyway, just email me if you'd like to get one. $1,295 delivered in the lower 48. $1,295 delivered the lower 48. And just email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, and we ship them all over the world, too. Here's a little basic information on our hydrogen that we breathe and drink the water from George Wiseman. And if I put the lever up, it would work. This was previously with George Wiseman about his AquaCure machine making hydrogen, gas, and water out of the same hose. Listen.
The body accepts that gas and uses it to heal everything. It's like the fountain of youth. It's astonishing the amount of ailments. In fact, in scientific studies, and they have over 1,000 scientific studies now, they're showing that it either helps the body heal directly or indirectly from virtually every ailment that ails any water-based life form. But it works just as well on animals and plants and lizards and birds and everybody.
And you're saying this because this machine called the AquaCure split into five different parts.
Six.
I got hydrogen, oxygen, electro, enhanced water, water vapors, monatomic hydrogen. What else?
And monatomic oxygen.
Oh, the monooxygen. And that's what your machine does? It splits it?
Yes, it makes that mixture inside the machine, and all that comes out a single hose, the same hose.
A gas?
As a gas, in gaseous form, yes.
And you breathe it or you put it in water?
So if you bubble the Brown's gas into this water,
yeah,
into, let's say, distilled water, it will go to a negative ORP. And when you drink that, it actually gives your body an electrical energy, these electrons. Instead of sucking energy from you, it gives it. So you can have water that is healthful and not healthful just by the energy that's in the water.
You want to get one? Me too. Ours is on the way. Well, that was 2 years ago, and we got it, and we've been breathing, and we love it. I think you'll enjoy it too. Try it. It's fun stuff. You can go to molecularhydrogeninstitute.org or com. I think it's a com. And check it out, and you'll see just hundreds and hundreds of peer-reviewed studies on the molecular hydrogen. It's used mostly in Japan and China, but they're beginning to do it now, and they're having some great results with cancer cells. We don't make any claims like it's going to cure your cancer. Don't trust me. We don't do that. But also with people recovering more easily from the dreaded strokes and all that when people, they lose mobility. So it's pretty interesting. MolecularHydrogenInstitute.org or com, I believe. And then just come on my website, patrick@oneradionetwork.com is the email if you'd like to get more questions. But then go to the website and you'll see the hydrogen there. Click on it, promo code ONE Radio, and you get yourself one. And And it's a lifetime warranty, so I think it's a pretty good thing to kind of do. You know what I mean?
From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Dr. Ray Pete is here. He is his website is raypete.com. He is a PhD in biology from the University of Oregon, specialization in physiology, and he's taught at different medical schools in Montana State University, spent some time in Mexico, and now is up in Oregon and is here once a month. So this is two or three questions on this one, so I'm going to do this one first, Dr. Pete. People are concerned with loved ones that even though that they didn't do this injection, they want to know about wives and husbands and daughters that have, anything that they can do to mitigate the potential dangers of this thing, whatever it is.
The spike protein is the toxic part of the virus when it infects you, and it's exactly the spike protein that is produced inside your body as a result of the vaccination. And so exactly the same things that protect you from the virus itself will help to protect against the symptoms of the spike protein injection. And those are basically anti-inflammatory things of all sorts, as long as they're non-toxic, and anticoagulant, and usually anti-inflammatory things tend to be also anticoagulants, because inflammation leads to clotting of the blood. The combined, some doctors like Peter McCullough use well-known drugs that are a combination of anticoagulant and anti-inflammatory. But common substances are orange juice, vitamin D, aspirin, progesterone, lidocaine even, coffee. Coffee has been found to be very protective against the COVID infection, and undoubtedly will help to protect against the vaccine.
Wow, good stuff. Coffee, orange juice, what's not to like, right? And I guess the ivermectin is a, Dr. Pete, is a anti-inflammatory. That's one of the big things that does?
Yep. Also, hydroxychloroquine, mm-hmm. Very anti-inflammatory. Bitter things in general tend to be helpful, anticoagulants and anti-inflammatory.
Bitter.
Quinine.
Oh, quinine.
One of our oldest broad-spectrum mm-hmm. drugs, mm-hmm. And chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine are derivatives of quinine.
Of quinine. Did they use quinine water years ago to help people get rid of some kind of disease?
Cramps. They help with sleep disorders and cramps by being anti-inflammatory.
Ah. Can you even get real quinine water these days? Do they sell it?
Yeah, tonic water, they call it.
Just tonic, quinine tonic water.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And it helps with sleep because it's anti-inflammatory.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Here's an email for you from Sharita. My daughter went to the gynecologist yesterday, and the doctor saw right off that she had a lump on her thyroid. My daughter is very thin, exercises every day, is cold most of the time, and her neck and ears have been bothering her. What is Dr. Pete think that this could be the cause, the lumps, and what could she do to shrink it?
Did she get blood tests?
I don't. She doesn't say, Doc.
When your TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, is chronically elevated because you have eaten thyroid blocking foods, which could be polyunsaturated fats or too much cabbage or related vegetables containing thyroid suppressors. The TSH keeps driving your thyroid gland to produce more thyroid hormone to compensate for the toxins in your diet. And that constant stimulation, if, for example, if you spend 40 years consuming iodized salt, the incidence of thyroid cancer is much higher. But the nodules are the first sign of something interfering with the function of your thyroid hormone, tending to keep your thyroid-stimulating hormone elevated unnecessarily.
Above one, and you like it below one, right? That's your
Actually, below 0.4.
Wow.
Is people in that range are basically immune to thyroid cancer.
Immune. And so do we know, Dr. Pete, why the little lumps form in a case like this, what they're doing? Is it just toxins?
It's just evidence of the thyroid being driven beyond its capacity. Something, for example, estrogen inhibits the release of active hormone, but it doesn't inhibit the creation of the protein called thyroglobulin, which leads to the active hormone. So a high estrogen person, late teens or around menopause are the times that the estrogen can get out of balance. Those are the times when the thyroid very often enlarges in women. But sometimes instead of enlarging evenly, being interfered with in ways that favor just a nodule formation.
I see. So that would coincide with oftentimes for low thyroid, some of the symptoms are often difficulty swallowing. So because the thyroid is enlarging?
Hoarseness. Vocal problems, sometimes loss even of vocal ability to make speech sounds.
I'll be.
Scrapy sore throat, difficulty swallowing, and so on. And you can pretty much see whether your own thyroid is enlarged. If you look in the mirror and swing your chin from side to side, the motion of the muscles, you'll see a sort of a thick pad to each side of your voice box. If the thyroid is very enlarged, you can see.
Oh, you can see it pop out.
A soft bulge that stays put. If the thyroid is shrunken by supplementing too much thyroid, you'll tend to see dents between the big muscle at the side of your neck and your voice box.
Hmm.
The thyroid gland normally makes that a smooth, inconspicuous, more or less continuous shape, but if it's shrunken too much, then you'll see an indentation in the absence of the thyroid. But the thyroid adjusts very quickly. So if you have shrunken it by taking too much, you stop taking the overdose, and just overnight, you can see the gland return to its normal size.
Interesting.
And if you take a large dose of thyroid supplement, the gland will quickly begin shrinking to a normal size.
Does the TSH level adjust that quickly as well? Like if you would go in and 2 weeks later, after changing something, or would you have to wait longer?
It changes in a matter of hours.
I'll be. Isn't that interesting? In a matter of hours.
The T4 thyroxin has a long half-life in the body of 2 weeks. So it takes about a month for that to change enough that you see a big change in your TSH. But if you're using a T3 supplement and you stop, the half-life of that is only about 12 hours to a day. And so in 2 or 3 days, if you've been on T3 only, then you'll see a tremendous increase in your TSH level because the thyroid level has dropped so fast.
Now, the basic thyroid meds that are out there, what are the ones that are even available right now? Is it Natrathroid? Is that still popular, Natrathroid?
The last thing I heard was that they were having some problem, and so a lot of the people were changing to Armor or Xenoplus. One of the other combinations. Novotiral and Xenoplus are two synthetic equivalents of the natural glandular.
But they work as the same well, if I understand, correct?
They have both active components, T3 and T4.
So the ones that are going around now, they're T3 and T4? They're a mixture?
Most practical physiological mixture imitates the natural glandular balance.
And the natural glandular balance, so what does that have in it? Are all of them as well?
It also has a little bit of the of precursors, T1 and T2. T2 works just the same as T3, practically. But there's only a very tiny amount of that.
Dr. Ray Pete, Patrick Timpone. Tomorrow we're going to talk with Charlie Sewell. Charlie's got a very concise, we think, well thought out. He has a whole team of one-page religious exemption for this jab. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. We'll go through it line by line. It's just one page. Not guaranteeing it's going to work, but if someone is forcing you to do something, you might want to get this. We'll send it to you, and you make two copies, send one, and we'll tell you how to do it. That'll be tomorrow, 10 o'clock. Charlie's a very smart guy. He's got some Supreme Court things in there, and pretty interesting. We think it'll... And then Dr. Thomas Cowan and Andrew Kaufman are going to be here tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and we'll talk more about their work. Dr. Pete, while I've got you here, I know that you've liked their work, Kaufman and Cowan, but you've disagreed with a few things. What's the number one thing you kind of disagree with their show me the virus theory?
You can demonstrate the existence of something without being able to isolate it, and they want isolation in the sense of being able to make pictures of it and then show that the substance you've photographed will produce the disease.
Right.
That has been done roughly, but the indirect evidence of the presence of a toxic material is the general practice. You can demonstrate the presence of certain antigens on the virus, and you can take it apart chemically and use different physical demonstrations that confirm the structure and the presence of the material, even though the preparation of the material for an electron microscope picture, you don't necessarily have to have a completely pure sample. You can distinguish by the shape of the substance what you have under the microscope, show that there are virus bodies present, that they sometimes look the same as exosomes or extracellular vesicles, but then you can show that they have the particular chemistry of the spike protein, and our naturally formed exosomes only have that spike protein when the either the DNA or the RNA has been assimilated, so that after you get the vaccination, our naturally formed exosomes are likely to contain some of the spike protein exactly the way the virus would have, but we wouldn't have assimilated the spike protein without exposure to either the virus or the vaccine. It's something so toxic that it's far from anything our bodies would naturally produce.
Right. On the isolation idea, I think, and I don't want to speak for them because it's above my pay grade, but don't they argue that if you don't have it totally, completely isolated, which no one has done in my understanding, then you don't know what people are potentially getting, like, you know, they do monkey kidneys and they starve the cell and they put, you know, toxins in there. Doesn't that argument hold water for you?
No, because there is such a long history of being able to modify the nucleic acids of animals, bacteria, viruses, everything. The technology exists for changing the DNA sequence. For example, in the 1990s, the Defense Department was collecting smallpox viruses and were experimenting with re-engineering them, the smallpox virus, to make it get around the vaccination so that it would be a bioweapon that would kill people and be just as effective in vaccinated individuals. You can do that with any of the existing diseases. You can modify them in the lab, and the germ warfare industry has been doing that, not publicizing it very much, but Ralph Baric in his lab in North Carolina and working with Fort Detrick and the military has expressed in his publications exactly some of the modifications that they are making in the coronavirus and other viruses to make them more infective, more toxic. So the technology is relatively open, even though it's we don't know the extent of how much is being done secretly still.
But could these things be this gain of function thing, or when they juice it up in the lab, could they even be released in the air, and you breathe it in and get them?
Yep.
Could you?
They've designed them so that they test them on animals. They put an air channel between cages and blow the air from one cage into another, and they can demonstrate that the disease is transmitted by air in some cases.
And then mammals could then share them with others?
Yeah, once they're infected, then it goes from one individual to another. If it's a highly infectious air transmission, but many viruses only are transmitted by body fluids.
But essentially, though, viruses aren't living, right? In the body, they're dead, aren't they?
They are analogs of our own nucleic acid systems, and so we are constantly producing virus-like particles. The exosomes are extracellular vesicles that carry genetic information around within our bodies, and those particles, our own natural exosomes, can be transmitted by body fluids and probably through exhalations. You can condense lots of proteins and nucleic acids just by holding a cold object under your nose when you exhale. So they're in a volatile form that condenses on a cold object. Our natural exosomes are included in that, sometimes free DNA, free RNA, other times it's packaged in a little capsule like an exosome.
So these are the guys that were sharing potentially beneficial information with other people, right?
And the toxic parts, like the spike protein, are what causes diseases. Some viruses are probably exosomes from some organism that simply is out of place. People were transmitting plant diseases by rubbing plant viruses with pumice powder into the leaves of the plants to produce some plant disease. And two of these people, working with a particular plant virus, which they rubbed in with their fingers in a pumice powder mixture, two of these researchers at the same university came down within a period of just a few months with a degenerative brain disease that killed them in a short time. So it's very likely that the plant viruses being rubbed into the skin with pumice is what caused the brain disease.
Wow. Fascinating. Here's an email from Mandy. Thanks for that, Doc. For someone with parasites and high toxin burden, how do you start slowly opening drainage pathways pre-tox without homeopathics? Oh, without homeopathy. So they're wanting to kind of get warmed up to detoxify, I guess it sounds like.
Did you say with parasites?
Yes, someone with parasites, right.
The first thing is to get rid of the parasites. Sometimes a change of diet, if they're in the intestine, just a radical change of diet, like a very high fiber diet sometimes is all it takes. Having more digestible foods. Sometimes flowers of sulfur is enough to get rid of certain parasite amoebas, for example. Sometimes are eliminated by just a small amount of flowers of sulfur. Other times, things like ivermectin, they worked against a great variety of parasites.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Harish. Adrenal glands are required for making cortisol and aldosterone from progesterone, right? How did progesterone substitute for the absence of adrenal glands in the Hans-Seils experiment? S-E-L-Y-E-S. Are you familiar?
Yeah, Hans Selye.
Yeah, that's it, Hans Selye. Thanks.
Was experimenting with the adrenal the stress syndrome, he would remove the adrenal glands study the effects of how the absence of the adrenals led to the stress sensitivity of the animal, so that a mild stress would kill them. But some of his animals happened to be pregnant when their adrenal glands were removed, and he found that they were perfectly stress tolerant as long as they were pregnant. And as soon as they delivered their litter, then the usual absence of the adrenals led to stress sensitivity and easy death from a mild shock. And so he experimented removing the adrenals and supplementing progesterone, and found that the animals would live a normal lifespan as long as they were supplemented just with progesterone, because the body can turn, intrinsically progesterone has anti-inflammatory functions that overlap with cortisol, and also intrinsic salt-regulating functions that overlap with aldosterone. And those middle-of-the-range functions of progesterone mean that if you're overdosed, if your adrenals are having a tumor, for example, making too much aldosterone or too much cortisol, dosing with progesterone mediates or moderates those effects, so that it acts as an antitoxin to the overdose of adrenal steroids. So it's a moderator of basically everything. Complementary to that progesterone anti-stress effect, he supplemented estrogen and found that large doses of estrogen created shock, as if analogous to removing the adrenals. The estrogen was an amplifier of stress and shock.
Wow. Well, very interesting. Here's an email from Chelsea for you, Doc. Hi, I recently, this month, started progesterone about 30 milligrams at night during the second 2 weeks of my cycle to deal with PCOS and fibroids. While I'm on it, it helps, and when I stop for the second 2 weeks, I feel bloated and discomfort in the ovaries. Any advice on dosage? Also, just started tiny amounts of Cylamel. Cylamel. It's C-Y-N.
You usually, behind deficiency of progesterone or the excess of estrogen in the luteal phase, usually the reason for that is low thyroid function. And supplementing thyroid will tend to lower the amount of estrogen in the body while raising the amount of progesterone, improving the ratio. Most often, normalizing your thyroid hormone function takes care of your estrogen, progesterone, premenstrual problems, such as PCOS.
Here's an email from Mandy. How would you deal with a heavy metal detox injury? Wow. I used a large dose of cilantro one day without realizing I had blocked detox pathways after a long time, a decade or so, of Lyme-like diseases. I seem to have triggered mast cell overactivation, and I'm not able to tolerate any drainage or detox, and I become extremely histamine, EMF, and sulfur intolerant. Wow.
Cilantro just happens to be a fairly strong allergen.
Oh.
The seeds of the plant are even worse. and that whole the compositae family of plants, the caraway seeds, for example, are similar. That whole family of plants can be extremely allergenic. So it I don't think has anything to do with metal detoxification. It's just that for some reason cilantro has that reputation, but really it's a good tasting herb with the risk of being extremely allergenic for some people.
So she may be assuming or maybe misdiagnosing this thing, and could be.
Yeah, in the sense of the detoxing. If you normalize your metabolism, get oxidative metabolism going, normal thyroid and hormone balances, then the metals will take care of themselves gradually, leaving in your urine.
What's Dr. Pete's view on mast cell activation and why mast cells become overactive?
Estrogen is a very powerful activator of and attractant to mast cells. And progesterone, by balancing the estrogen effect, will neutralize that. Overactive bladder syndrome is a common effect of chronically high estrogen production.
Here's one from Ben. I'm 72, male, want to gain more muscle, have followed your idea of not taking in too much iron. So what can I safely eat to build up testosterone and subsequent muscle?
The right kind of muscle activity in itself will increase your testosterone. Resistance activity of the muscles, up to a limit. You don't want to overstress your muscles or reach the point of getting out of breath. But if you gradually use resistance exercise to build your muscles, that in itself is lowering the catabolic cortisone category of steroids, while increasing the testosterone or androgen category.
And then it matters not too much about what you're eating. They'll grow if you do that.
Just keep your protein intake in a normal range.
No. Would you please ask Dr. Pete about what medicine to take if I catch the coronavirus? I get very sick from histamine intolerance, and that makes me worried about the virus.
The Chinese at the very beginning, late 2019, that they were finding that antihistamines and anti-serotonin drugs that they were familiar with were specifically acting protectively against that virus. Something like ciproheptadine, a common antihistamine, anti-serotonin drug, it's known to be helpful. But right from the very beginning, that was one of the important observations in China.
Mm-hmm. Ray Pete is here, generally on the third Monday, but we had technical difficulties yesterday. This is from somebody in Florida. Sin, whenever I eat well-boiled mushrooms, caps without the stems, cooked for 3 hours, I don't sleep well. Does Dr. Pete have any idea on why this would be?
Could be an allergy, I suppose. It's good to avoid things, especially late in the day, to avoid things that might not fit your digestive system. having easily digestible carbohydrates late in the day is usually best for good sleep.
And what are those easily digestible ones?
I like orange juice and ice cream.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Sometimes tortillas.
Uh-huh. Corn tortillas?
Nixtamalized.
Nixtamalized.
Lime processed.
Yeah. Do you make your own?
Rarely. Yeah. It's quite a process.
Yeah. But you could actually buy the nixtamalized ones?
If you look carefully at the labels, they should contain nothing but corn, a lime processed corn.
Oh. Pretty fun. Could you ask Dr. Pete about, microfiber sheets for sleeping? Also, often cotton shirts and underwear are combined with some polyester in the fabric. Are these clothing articles made with polyester possibly hazardous to our health?
They aren't ideal. The polyester tends to allow bacterial growth. The cotton, by being absorbent on a very deep level, effectively is somewhat antiseptic. So I think natural organic cotton is always the best fiber. Wool next best.
Mm-hmm.
Flax or linen, very safe if it's organic.
Here's one. Could you please ask Dr. Pete if being on a low-calorie diet lowers the thyroid, and how can a person go back to eating a normal amount of calories without weight gain?
That involves getting the right balance of electrolytes and carbohydrate in particular, and then generally avoiding fats because of the anti-metabolic polyunsaturated. But getting enough sodium and potassium, calcium, and magnesium is the essential thing, because they will minimize stress and stop some of the catabolic processes, and then the carbohydrate and protein will work more efficiently.
I see. With Dr. Ray Pete, it is the 21st. We are live here. Oh, you mentioned electrolytes, Doc. I wanted to ask. I like to do saunas, and I do plenty of water with some electrolytes. Any foods that would help me to make sure that I'm not over-saunering, sweating?
I think when you artificially increase your body temperature,
mm-hmm.
you burn sugar very fast. Orange juice is a good thing to have during and right after a sauna. Endurance athletes have discovered that having some baking soda in water before the stressful exercise greatly increases their endurance. What it's doing is guaranteeing that you will oxidize your glucose most efficiently, and the carbon dioxide released from the baking soda is part of it. The sodium is contributes. Specific requirement of each of the alkaline minerals, magnesium, calcium, potassium, and sodium, it isn't as important as the total alkaline load. One, to a great extent, will supplement a deficiency of the other. For example, when the parathyroid glands were removed, leading to the cramps because of the theory was that it was simply an absolute calcium deficiency causing the cramping, but experimenters found that sodium bicarbonate we would relax the cramps, even with the deficiency of parathyroid and calcium. So there's an overlap, which is essentially an alkalizing effect.
Interesting. I could also do some fat, some milk, right, with some sugar in it too, would help? Like something like that?
Yeah, the calcium in the milk is extremely important for keeping your parathyroid under control. So calcium and sodium are the ones that we have to pay most attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Vegetables and fruits are loaded in general with magnesium and potassium, and so the calcium and sodium are more likely to be deficient in those.
Dr. Pete, Mark wants to know if you can explain to him how to be properly hydrated in general.
Keeping the minerals up is a big part of it. If your thyroid is working, you will retain minerals appropriately and keep your minerals in balance, and that will keep you on an anabolic balance, and the production of carbon dioxide helps to regulate both the fluids and the minerals such as sodium.
Mm-hmm. Here's a good question, Dr. Pete Foy, from Samantha. I'm sure a lot of people will benefit. What's the best way to purify water at home if I'm not able to do an RO system, reverse osmosis, in my apartment? So she wants to purify water, in particular, removing fluoride. So she's asking about maybe a distiller, ceramic filters like Berkey, or charcoal filters.
For fluoride, I think the only way to do it is distillation.
Distillation. That gets rid of it, right? I think, doesn't it?
What was that?
The distillation gets rid of fluoride, doesn't it, Dr. P?
Sure. All of the minerals, lead, mercury, aluminum, everything in the dirty water supply.
Right. So maybe that'd be the easiest way, the most inexpensive way, right? Just get a little distiller machine. Wow. This is interesting from Leanne. I'm moving towards 50. I'm still having my periods, and I'd like to extend my fertility life, as I'd like to wait another year or two before I have another baby, before I can't any longer. Any advice from Dr. Pete? Thanks for the show. That's a good question. So she's still menstruating, close to 50, and she wants to move it forward. Any ideas on what you can do?
Watching the general nutrition is first thing, but in women of any age who are approaching menopause, sometimes it happens in the 40s even, and going to fertility clinics, I've known women who failed repeatedly at the fertility various procedures, who, if they just took thyroid hormone, immediately got pregnant. Sometimes in my nutrition classes, just by changing their diet, people who had thought they were infertile for 10 years would suddenly get pregnant just during a 2 or 3 months class.
Just more of a variety of good nutrients, of all the vitamins and minerals.
And thyroid is the essential fertility hormone, because it keeps down excessive estrogen and keeps up your pregnenolone and progesterone production.
I guess there's probably no clock on women's menstruation. I guess it just depends. You know, no real time clock on it?
No. At one of my talks, an old gynecologist said, at the end of the talk, he said, yeah, progesterone is good stuff. he pointed to his wife, who was a very young-looking woman. He said, I've been giving her progesterone for 20 years, and she's 63 and still menstruating.
Is that right? Progesterone?
Yeah, and her overall appearance was maybe 40 years old.
Is that? And she was 63, so, wow.
Uh-huh.
So this is kind of complicated, but this lady really wants to some help, and so I'm going to do it here, so bear with me. She says, I had preeclampsia in both of my pregnancies, more severe the second time, and was put on a magnesium drip. My doctor and midwife said it was very dangerous for me to consider having another baby because of my history of preeclampsia. I have a better understanding now, but there are things, I can do to prepare before pregnancy again, but I want to hear from Dr. Pete what causes preeclampsia and what can be done to prevent it from happening again. Well,
if you can find any of the writings of Tom Brewer from the 1950s, especially through the 1960s.
Tom Brewer, okay.
He showed that a protein deficiency and to some extent other deficiencies, especially sodium, he ranted about the dangers of salt restriction during pregnancy leading to preeclampsia. But he basically had the cure for it in 1960s. When he died, his wife, Gail, I think, rewrote some of his material and I think got the essential ideas wrong. So don't look for the Tom Brewer diet, but look for the actual writings of Tom Brewer. A book that he referred to, written by Shanklin and Hoden, H-O-D-I-N, on maternal and child nutrition, I think was the title, emphasized the importance of sodium during pregnancy. But Brewer advocated drinking at least a quart, I think maybe 2 quarts of milk per day during pregnancy was his advice.
Wow.
And he essentially prevented all of the expected cases of preeclampsia. Thyroid is another factor. If magnesium drips help, it's because the body is deficient in oxidative metabolism as a result of being low in thyroid, and therefore the cells don't retain magnesium. An allergist had the interesting experience of giving magnesium intravenously every week to his allergic patients, but he found that almost all the magnesium that he put in came right out in their urine a few hours later. And if he gave them some thyroid hormone, especially T3, along with the magnesium intravenous dose, that the magnesium stayed in their body and didn't show up in the urine. And the side effect was that they had their allergies cured and didn't come back for more treatments.
Wow. Fascinating. So what's with this thyroid? I mean, this seems like it's just everywhere, right? Thyroid issues. Do you have any theories on the spiritual or components of what's going on planet Earth with a thyroid? I mean, why so much? Why so much stuff?
It's the basic process of forming energy using oxygen and making carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is essential for every organism, bacteria, protozoa, whatever, they need carbon dioxide to go through the life processes, mm-hmm. cell division and so on, mm-hmm. And to make carbon dioxide, thyroid hormone is the trigger for making endless amounts of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is what stabilizes the electronic balance in cells, so it's right at the heart of everything living.
So that's the idea of not over-breathing and retaining more carbon dioxide, even when exercising, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Wow. Carbon. And so do you think then stress of modern-day life and over-breathing, mouth-breathing, that could be causing dispensing so much carbon dioxide, which could be affecting thyroid in our culture?
And the other way.
The other way.
The bad foods that interfere with thyroid hormone create... at the very beginning, they are creating hyperventilation equivalent. No matter how much you breathe, if your thyroid is underactive, your body is experiencing hyperventilation.
Hyperventilation. And there's actually... go ahead. Sorry.
The harder you breathe, the more carbon dioxide you blow out.
Right.
And so if you... pant intensively in a minute or so, you tend to faint. That's because the carbon dioxide level in your brain has thrown the whole electronic system out of balance and shut off oxygen use.
So then, kind of standard American diet with and PUFAs, I suspect, then they cause this hyperventilation as well?
Yeah, and you can see in the blood as the CO2 goes down, lactic acid and a lot of other things increase in inflammatory.
As the CO2 goes down.
Yeah.
And how do we retain more CO2? Is there things we can do?
Sugar and salt.
Sugar. Good old sugar. To the rescue, man, sugar. Sugar and salt. Good salt, right?
Yeah. That's because they support the thyroid function.
And you still like your favorite is the Morton's pickling and canning salt, pure sodium chloride, right?
Yeah, so you don't get an excess of iodine.
You know, I got some the other day, Dr. Pete. I think it was $1.25 for a huge box of this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, okay, man. Oh, here's a P.S. on Catherine. She said, is supplementing, you know, the eclampsia lady, Doc, with whole food vitamin C okay, eclampsia?
Vitamin C?
Whole food vitamin C. Is that okay?
What does that mean, whole
She
food?
Wants to know if taking a whole food vitamin C supplement is okay.
It depends on what they mean.
What it is, huh?
If you leave out pasta and bread and nuts from your diet, the remaining foods all contain ascorbic acid. So the reason a goat, for example, is known to produce 3,000 or 4,000milligrams of vitamin C per day, and Linus Pauling said we have to supplement that much because that's how much the animals produce if they have the system for producing their own vitamin C. But I looked at my vitamin C production or emission, analyzing the amount in my urine, and I found that taking no supplement at all, just eating regular foods, milk and meat, eggs, vegetables, and so on, I was putting out around 3,000 milligrams per day, every day in my urine.
3,000, okay.
So it's apes, for example, mm-hmm. eating lots of vegetables and occasional bugs and slugs and things are getting as much vitamin C as a goat, which can make its own vitamin C. So there's no need to supplement if you don't eat the vitamin C free foods such as grains and nuts and beans.
Because they'll dispense vitamin C out of the body? They'll get rid of it?
No, those
they just don't have any vitamin.
Simply don't have any.
Don't have any.
But milk, for example, and meat is a major source of vitamin C that the explorers found that they didn't have to take lemons or canned fruit with them when they were spending months in the Arctic. If they ate meat, because meat, they proved that meat was a very good source of vitamin C. It turns out that all animal tissues contain lots of vitamin C, but they were simply not measuring the right material. Vitamin C, the reductant, is not the biologically effective intracellular vitamin C. It's the dehydroascorbate. It functions as an oxidant, not an antioxidant, in our cells. And you have to use a different procedure for measuring the oxidant form of vitamin C, which is intracellular. And so if you use the wrong technique, you're simply blind to the amount of actual vitamin C effect in our foods.
Why?
And all the official agencies are still deliberately staying blind to the amount of vitamin C in our diet.
Fascinating. So all these health food stores selling cod liver oil or fish oil and vitamin C, probably not the best choice. We have to know what we're doing here.
Yeah.
That's why we have guys like you on, gentlemen like you on, to help us, because, man, it's a landmines out there with all the things we've been taught over the years, even in the natural food business, right, Doc? I mean, all the health food stores selling all these things? Shoot.
Oh, yeah, the propaganda is huge. So powerful.
Whoa, it's big. A couple more, then we'll let you go. Oh, here is one. John, he's in Los Angeles, 50-year-old man. What can I eat or take to improve my teeth health? They're not in good shape. Well, teeth, tooth.
The teeth?
Yeah, teeth.
When I was in Mexico City, I went several months. I didn't wake up early enough to get to the supermarket to get the good-tasting milk. And so I went on a low-milk, almost milk-free diet for several months. And all of my teeth became very sensitive to the cold or any stimulation, and then one of them started crumbling, not decay, but just weakness and pieces of it breaking off. And after I'd started reading about calcium metabolism, I found a huge Sandoz calcium supplement. I took just one or two of those, about 1,000 milligrams of calcium each, and within hours, the sensitivity of my teeth had gone back to normal. Just an amazing turning off of the total dental pain. So that woke me up to the importance of regular calcium.
Calcium.
Generous intake of calcium and vitamin D.
And that's why you like milk rather than... And you did this with just some store-bought calcium that we don't really recommend, that kind of stuff? It worked?
The milk comes the milk. With an adequate amount of magnesium to balance it, some of the other minerals, as well as the sugars and fats that help us assimilate the calcium properly. Mm. So the effect of milk is many times better than a calcium supplement.
Has there been many cultures in your research, Dr. Pete, that have drunk milk and children and ongoing through adulthood? A lot of cultures in the last 1,000 years or so? Lots?
For thousands of years throughout Asia there have been cow-based cultures.
Uh-huh. Wow. And they did well on it, obviously. They wouldn't keep drinking it, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's just so interesting. I mean, you know, all the so-called natural docs out there, they just think milk is the devil.
Yeah.
But it tastes good. You know, I've been drinking it since talking to you. I like it. You know, I didn't drink milk my whole life. But, you know, when we were kids, we drank lots of milk with cereal and sugar, and we did okay, you know.
There has been so much propaganda against milk too.
Yeah.
Talking about cholesterol, for example.
Right.
It's a big propaganda industry rather than a science industry throughout the world of nutrition.
Sure, sure. Well, Dr. Pete, what you going to do today? Anything fun? You'll probably always have fun, right? What are you doing?
Right now I'm reading about immunology. I'm going to do a newsletter related to the immune system that the propagandists are still working to deny the basic nature of our immune system.
Oh, that'll be fun. And that'll come out in a month or two?
A few weeks.
A few weeks. And so if you'd like to get this, I'm looking forward. It's just Ray Pete's newsletter, raypetesnewsletter@gmail.com, and you can sign up and he'll take care of it for you. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate it. You're just a wonderful guy, and thank you. Just thanks.
Okay.
So much. Thanks.
Thank
so much.
You.
You take care of yourself, okay? We'll see you next week, next month.
Oh, okay. Bye.
Thanks, Doc. Dr. Ray Pete, raypete.com. Wow, man, what a nice guy. He's the bomb, right? That's his website. Get his newsletter. Support him. It's really fun. I think it's, if I can make my mouse work, make sure it's right. Yeah, it's raypete.com. But his newsletter is Ray Pete's, it's plural, newsletter@gmail.com. Immunology. That's coming up. Well, that was fun. Great email. Thanks for all your questions. And well, I will see you tomorrow. We're going to have a good time. We'll be talking to you at 10 o'clock tomorrow. 10 o'clock tomorrow. Charlie Sewell is going to be here. Charlie's been working on, with his little team of constitutional geeks. It's going to be a one-page, we've got it, a one-page religious exemption thing that he thinks is going to work. I mean, we can't, not making any promises, but if you're up against that little thing, and we'll talk to Charlie about it, and we're going to go through it line by line so you understand what it says, and you can, you know, share it with people, and we'll share it with you. That'll be tomorrow at 10, and then Dr. Cowan, and Kaufman. We're going to be here tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Get your questions in for those two pumpkins. They're fun. Dr. Andrew Kaufman, Thomas Cowan, 1 o'clock, oneradionetwork.com. Send in your questions now for the Wednesday at 1 o'clock show. So thank you so much for your ongoing support. Again, yeah, I'm still getting people that want to look at the 20 hours of the Lost History videos that get into the whole non-movable earth, non-spinning thing. Yeah. So, you know, just email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. If you would like to get some good things for your health, like sulfur, or aloe, or a sauna, or hydrogen or pine pollen or Shen Blossom. I didn't mention them today. Shen Blossom, great website. The Blue Shield, where it protects you, your helps you with your EMFs, electromagnetic, whatever those things are. Dr. Cowan, speaking of him, he has some great powders. Some of my faves are burdock, dandelion, turmeric. He's got these powders, Dr. Cowan, on our website, and you can sprinkle these on your food. I'm going to have some scallops tonight. You can sprinkle them on there. See, Dr. Pete's got me on scallops. Now, he doesn't have me on, but he said they got a better... I don't even know why they're better. It's so much information sometimes I just... But, you know, he said they're the best choice for seafood. Scallops is a very good choice. I think it's low... Is it iron? Iron? Than regular fish. I do what I can, you know. I like scallops. They're good. Okay, kids, we'll see you in the morning. Thanks for everything. I love you. I really, you could be crying already. I really appreciate your emails lately. It's been amazing. They're coming out of the woodwork. People just appreciate what we do. And, you know, that's worth all the commissions in the world, because we're good as long as we make our house payment. I don't care. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, I'm good. I don't need anything. Prius gets about 40 miles a gallon, so not much on gas expenses and a little bit of food and house payment. We're good. It's amazing. Okay, I love you guys. Thank you. Take care. We'll see you tomorrow, 10 o'clock.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.